From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, December 14th, 2016. And on this day, three members of Maine's congressional delegation celebrate a legislative victory that benefits Maine's New Balance factories, but they say a fight is looming to maintain the provision. The head of Maine's Department of Education is resigning after a controversial tenure made possible by some administrative maneuvers by Governor Paul LePage. And a national coalition is calling on judges and state and local policymakers to stop the practice of putting juvenile offenders in jail. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
I'm Barbara Caridi. Three members of Maine's congressional delegation were together today in Skowhegan to visit an athletic shoe factory they say will benefit from the latest Defense Authorization Act. As Mal Leary reports, the delegation is working to fend off a potential challenge to the Made in the USA provision that could arise in the new Congress.
The battle over providing the American military with uniforms and equipment made in the USA goes back to World War II. Just months before the war began, Congress passed legislation requiring that most products for military use be made in the United States. But over the years, that requirement was eroded, and new items, including athletic footwear, were not covered. Maine's members of Congress have been working for a decade on a provision to include athletic footwear and managed to have it added into this year's National Defense Authorization Act. That's a victory for the New Balance factory in Skowhegan, one of three in Maine that make athletic shoes.
It's about maintaining the jobs we have in the state of Maine and the state of Massachusetts.
Brendan Melly is a manager at New Balance.
As a veteran myself of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the reason I came to New Balance is because we do what's right. It's because we focus on Made in the USA and keeping jobs here in the United States.
New Balance has 900 workers at three main factories in Skowhegan, Norridge Walk, and Norway. The legislation calls for over 200,000 pairs of athletic shoes a year for new military recruits. And New Balance is the only shoemaker that meets the requirements for the provision. But delegation members acknowledge that the next authorization could be changed. Republican 2nd District Congressman Bruce Poliquin had to battle in committee and on the floor of the House to keep the provision in the bill and is worried that another battle will occur in 2017.
I'm always concerned about that. And that's why it's so important to fight on behalf of our workers, behalf of the companies like New Balance and employ our workers here in the state of Maine. But we're going to battle down there. We're going to leave no stone unturned.
And the Maine delegation has been unified in the fight. First District Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, a Democrat, did not attend the Skowhegan event, but has worked to line up Democratic votes, just as Poliquin fought against fellow Republican House members that objected to the legislation in the name of free trade. It was a battle in the Senate as well, and Republican Senator Susan Collins has no doubt that it will arise again in the new Congress that takes office next month.
This was a major victory, but the fight is not over. I fully expect that there'll be an attempt to repeal the provision.
Senator Angus King, an independent, also expects efforts to repeal the measure in committee and on the floor in the new Congress. President Obama has said he will sign the National Defense Authorization Act. But work on a new authorization measure gets underway soon after Congress goes back to work in January. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Meanwhile, the head of Maine's Department of Education is stepping down, according to the LePage administration. Dr. William Beardsley's nomination was never vetted by the legislature, and he has led the department thanks to a series of controversial maneuvers by the governor. Steve Missler has more.
The administration says Dr. William Beardsley, who has led the department since 2015, is resigning for personal reasons. Dr. Robert Hassan, who was recently appointed as the acting commissioner, will now lead the DOE. Beardsley was installed by the governor after the departure of Jim Ryer. The governor had hoped to make the former president of Hudson University the department's commissioner, but he withdrew his nomination after asserting that Democrats were conspiring to block him. Beardsley has continued as the de facto head of the department through a series of administrative maneuvers by the governor. Those maneuvers have been sharply criticized by Democrats, who say the education chief should be vetted by the legislature. A spokesman for the governor would not say if Hassan will be nominated to become commissioner. He is the former superintendent of Maine School Administrative District 51, which includes Cumberland and North Yarmouth. He holds a BS degree in elementary education from St. Joseph's College and a doctorate in education from Boston College. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
And in Bangor, a citywide minimum wage increase that was supposed to go into effect January 1st has been delayed for 6 months, while legislative efforts are underway to implement a citizen initiative for a statewide hourly wage hike. Bangor City Councilor Joe Perry was among councilors who said they had originally been prepared to repeal the local minimum wage entirely in the event that voters approved the citizen initiative for a higher minimum wage statewide.
Because of concern of what they might do in Augusta in this legislative session, instead of repealing it, we seek to push this off till July 1st of next year to see what happens during this legislative session. And I suppose there's no harm in keeping this on the books in case they do make changes that brings the state minimum wage below ours, which is highly unlikely. I agree. No harm there. That's a compromise we made.
The increase delayed Monday evening by the Bangor City Council would have raised hourly wages from the current $7.50 an hour to $8.25. Meanwhile, a panel of scientists says Maine could greatly increase private sector investment in clean energy by creating a so-called green bank. The Union of Concerned Scientists says that would improve access to capital needed to finance energy upgrades. Steve Klemmer, Energy Research Director with the group and the lead author of the analysis, says green banks could be created through state agencies such as Efficiency Maine or the Finance Authority of Maine.
One of the biggest advantages of a green bank or other financing programs for clean energy is that it can attract significant private sector investment in renewable energy and energy efficiency technologies using a fairly limited amount of public money to do so.
And that can have what Klemmer calls enormous benefits for Maine's economy and for consumers who could save money on their electricity bills. Klemmer says establishing the program with an initial $14 million public investment would leverage $300 million in private sector investments over 15 years. Coming up, a national coalition of youth advocacy groups says most youthful offenders should be placed in community-based programs, not in jail. In Bangor, Eastern Maine Medical Center is joining the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative. As Patty White reports, the collaboration will help bring the latest in cancer treatment to northern Maine.
Eastern Maine Medical Center and Dana-Farber have worked together for decades, but EMMC's Medical Director of Cancer Care, Dr. Merrill Garrett, says joining the collaborative gives EMMC physicians opportunities to shadow and consult with specialists at Dana-Farber. It will also make it easier for patients to participate in clinical trials that were previously only available in Boston.
The TRIAD trials were interesting. They fit the trials. It would have been good for them, but they really couldn't travel weekly or every other week or every third week to Boston to be on the trial. So a lot of their trials are now going to be coming here.
A doctor with Dana-Farber says the collaboration goes both ways and that working with EMMC will further Dana-Farber's understanding of cancer and improve treatment. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Meanwhile, Planned Parenthood of Northern New England is applauding the Obama administration's move to finalize a new rule known as Title X, which is intended to protect cancer screenings, birth control, and other basic health care for more than 4 million people across the country, including 10,000 in Maine.
It says that, you know, political motivations around access to abortion can't inform or be used to restrict access to federal funds for family planning services.
That's Planned Parenthood spokeswoman Nicole Clegg. Clegg says Title X provides federal funds for reproductive health care services to low-income adults and young people.
It's those funds that allow Planned Parenthood and other family planning providers to provide free or discounted care to thousands of people.
Clegg says there are concerns that the rule could come under attack in Congress or in the new Trump administration. And a national coalition of youth advocacy groups is calling on judges and state and local policymakers around the country to end the practice of youth incarceration. Instead, the National Collaboration for Youth says jails should only be used for a small number of violent kids and that other youthful offenders should be placed in community-based programs. To bolster the argument, the coalition released a report that says there's overwhelming evidence to show that youth prisons are harmful, ineffective, and excessively expensive. Susan Sharon has more.
The report, titled Beyond Bars, Keeping Young People Safe at Home and Out of Youth Prisons, backs up what Deborah Hodges says has become crystal clear in research over the past several years.
Research shows that locking up youth makes kids worse. And once they are returned to the community, they can actually pose a greater threat.
Hodges is the juvenile court administrator in Lucas County, Ohio, which has become a national model for the growing juvenile justice reform movement. Instead of locking up nonviolent kids for their crimes, Lucas County is taking a targeted approach to dealing with them, offering counseling, drug treatment, and other community and even school-based services. In a conference call with reporters, Hodges and others said it's a strategy that saves money and prevents recidivism.
We really do not have to make this up anymore. We know what works and we should be doing it.
Here in Maine, advocates for at-risk kids and kids themselves are also on board with the approach.
I have one top concern, I guess, and it's that I believe that locked facilities for children are harming children.
Paige Nichols is a learning specialist at the Portland-based Real School, which works with middle and high school students with behavioral and mental health issues. It's replaced the traditional one-size-fits-all approach to discipline, such as suspension and detention, with a restorative justice model. But because of their behavior, some of the students have spent time at the Long Creek Youth Development Center in South Portland. And if Nichols had her wish, tens of thousands of dollars spent incarcerating each kid every year could be redirected to alternative programs closer to where they live.
And that's a lot of money that could be cut in half even and go into really quality services, residential living programs, great mental health services, where kids can stay connected to their community while rehabilitating. Because the juvenile justice system was designed to be rehabilitative, and it's not.
I spent 13 months in Long Creek, worst 13 months of my life, tried to commit suicide three times.
18-year-old Austin Simmons of Poland says the main reason he wound up at Long Creek was because he didn't have a stable family life. He was kicked out of the house for the first time at age 14, living mostly out of a car for several months until he got caught driving without a license. Sent home again, Simmons says he repeatedly clashed with both of his parents and especially with his mother's boyfriend, who didn't like the fact that he was openly gay. This culminated with a fight in the kitchen in which Simmons says he grabbed a knife to defend himself. No one was hurt, but Simmons was charged with criminal threatening with a dangerous weapon and terrorizing.
I was put in Long Creek several times because they were like, what do we do with this kid? I will be the first to openly admit I have made mistakes. I did things that I shouldn't have done. I said things I shouldn't have done. I will be the first to admit that. However, I don't think that any human being should have to pay the price that I paid for those simple things.
Simmons says the state should have options available for kids like him who need some support and accountability but who don't belong in jail. Mohammed Mohammed of Lewiston says he spent 2.5 years in Long Creek for repeatedly getting into trouble. He says he understands that incarceration serves a purpose for some kids, but in general, he says, it hurts them and their families.
First is like, why would you take a kid that's been with his family member since he was born? And now you can only see them like once a week, twice a week. Some of them, they live far away. So how do you expect a teenager to grow up?
The report finds that exposing kids to social isolation is harmful. that a strong sense of belonging and positive relationships are among the reasons they succeed. And Joseph Jackson of the Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition says that's why confining kids to a cell is illogical. It's not conducive to rehabilitation or, he says, to their social growth.
I think we have to be concerned about that. You're interrupting these young people's lives at a crucial time when it's most important for them to develop socially as well.
According to the National Collaboration for Youth, the lack of full services in the community is often used as a justification to incarcerate young people who have complex and diverse needs and who repeatedly get into trouble. An email to the Maine Department of Corrections seeking comment for this story was not returned. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Wiscasset-based filmmaker Sumner McCain's latest film explores the story of a Belfast company that in the early 20th century documented small-town life in the Northeast through the medium of photo postcards. Postcards were a big deal in the early 1900s, and at the time, new technology allowed an army of camera-toting salesmen to turn them into a good living, and later, an historical archive. Of the roughly 75,000 glass plate negatives the Eastern Illustrating and Publishing Company shot, more than 40,000 are at the Penobscot Marine Museum. McCain uses these, along with oral histories, historians, and both original and period music, to tell that story. Nora Flaherty talked with McCain and asked him about the Eastern Illustrating and Publishing Company.
Basically, what the company did was they were based out of Belfast, and Herman Cassens, the owner of Eastern Illustrating, would send out four or five photographers throughout New England, starting in the spring, and they would stay out all summer and shoot every small town they could possibly find, and go into hotels and stores and ask the owners if they'd want a Eastern Illustrating postcard rack on the counter at their store or hotel. And they'd shoot images, send the negatives back to Belfast, and get them sent back and set up their little display in the stores and go from town to town and do that throughout the summer.
The thing that Eastern Illustrating did, was this unique to this company, or were there places like all over the country that were doing this sort of thing?
It was pretty unique to Eastern because they shot these tiny towns that the bigger postcard publishers weren't in or didn't shoot. So they had the market on these little tiny towns throughout the Northeast. And at the time, you could get mail two times a day. So that was how people communicated. So I could, you know, if I wanted to have you over for dinner, I could send a postcard in the morning. You could send a reply and would have it all squared away by that night. So they were pretty big.
And they said, well, your neighbor's got telephone put in just a few days ago. You're right next house. Why don't you call her up and talk to her? You mean talk to her from here? And he said, yes. He said, I don't believe it. Don't believe you can talk to her from here.
These photos tell stories about a particular period in American history and Maine in it.
The world went so fast. People didn't have to have everything. And everybody was practically happy.
Everything is ripped and gone now. It's too fast for old people. If you could come up here in 1900... you'd really enjoyed it more than you do now.
If you think about it, from 1909 to the 50s, we had World War I, World War II, the Great Depression, the Roaring Twenties, Prohibition. And these guys, Eastern's photographers, were shooting through all these, you know, pivotal time periods in our history. You can see little hints of the eras in the postcards. So obviously Prohibition, customs houses everywhere, you know, the lumber towns. You can see, I mean, the towns in northern Maine were bustling at the time. And you take a look at Millinocket in the 30s, and it looks like a completely different town.
Any images that stood out for you particularly?
There's one, oddly, of a customs agent in Madawaska that there was just something about it. It told a story. It was the custom agent standing outside the custom house at the end of the International Bridge in Madawaska. And that, it just kind of stood out to me. There was something about it. And it was a catalyst to come up with some kind of way to tell a bigger story than just the Eastern story, although that's fascinating in itself. So I was going through some oral histories that I had and some interviews, older interviews that were done in the 60s. And I came across one from a woman who grew up in Madawaska. And she was telling the story of smuggling booze across the International Bridge in the 20s during Prohibition.
So I went across the river, and I was wearing this raccoon fur coat. And at the time, I was going out with a custom officer. And when I came back over, I had the pint of brandy in my sleeve. And he was on duty.
That led to me looking for more oral histories to match up with these images.
In making this film, did you find anything new about Maine that you hadn't known before?
Oh, let's see. Another little story that was told by Bill Bunting, a historian who I interviewed for the film, talking about how when the river drivers would come out of the woods in Patton, Maine, after the river drive, all the women were expected to stay inside.
And that was not because they had any fear of them, because these guys would do nothing to them, but it was so they would not be embarrassed, that their behavior would have been noticed by women. So it was just a civic sort of agreement,
yeah,
that the women would stay out of sight so that the guys wouldn't be embarrassed by their behavior.
So little things like that, this sort of civic arrangement out of respect for those who were working in the woods in northern Maine, it kind of tells the story of, you know, northern Maine at the time. Just a little story like that when Patton was bustling. And it's, you know, you go up there now and it looks totally different.
All right, Sumner McCain, Maine filmmaker, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Nora Flaherty talking with filmmaker Sumner McCain. McCain's film, The Northeast by Eastern, airs tomorrow night at 10 on Maine Public Television. You can find information about additional airings on our website, mainepublic.org. And now here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
Temperatures are about to commence the free fall right through Friday, yet will rebound sharply by Sunday. Overnight, clouds will continue to expand across Maine, and there will be continuation of flurries north in mountains. Temperatures by dawn, single numbers north, about 20 in Kittery. Tomorrow will be much colder than today as Arctic air plummets into the state. Skies mostly cloudy over northern Maine in the mountains, partly cloudy throughout the remainder of the state. Quite windy tomorrow. There will be scattered flurries statewide and a possible isolated snow squall. Temperatures will barely recover, low teens north to mid-20s far south. Friday will dish out the depth of Arctic air. It will be windy and frigid throughout the state with dangerously low wind chill values. Partly sunny north in mountains, mostly sunny southern and central counties. Temperatures single numbers north to upper teens south. Saturday initially quiet with snow arriving south in the morning along the New Brunswick border during the afternoon. It will mix with sleet and freezing rain throughout the interior, rain along the coast by dusk. Upper teens north to middle to upper 30s along the coast. Sunday balmy. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, December 14th, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Mal Leary, Steve Missler, Patty White, A.J. Higgins, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening.